Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The leak has been stopped for now. There's a new guy set to take over, but BP does still have this one nagging thing to worry about. The billions of dollars it's losing, that is. What the company's profit report today really means. Also, how much national debt is too much? And our reporter gives away her data just to get you a good story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, everybody, the 27th of July. Good, as always, to have you with us. BP came out with its quarterly profit report this morning, or more to the point, the quarterly losses, $17 billion in red ink, the biggest loss ever for a British company, thanks in part to a massive set-aside to pay for that leak down in the Gulf. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark is here to help us make sense of it all. Hey, Chrissy.
Hi, Kai.
So break down this number, this morning's numbers for us, would you? Because the drilling's not quite done yet. The cleanup is certainly not done. How do they know how much they lost?
So it's part math, it's part guesswork, and it's also part strategy. There are a lot of numbers here, so bear with me. They actually made $5 billion in profit.
From operations, right?
Exactly. But that was all negated by their estimate that they're going to lose $32 billion over the next several years in cleanup costs. That's where the guesswork and the strategizing comes in, because BP doesn't want to admit maximum liability
right
here. That would imply that this was more than just an accident, that they were grossly negligent here. And if that were the case, the fines, first of all, would go up from about $1,000 a barrel of spilled oil a day to $4,000 a barrel. It would also mean that they would have to pay for the entire bill. Right now, they are banking on the assumption that they're going to split this liability with their partners in this well. So they would only be paying for 65% of this. So this $32 billion number kind of allows BP to go under the maximum liability without looking like they're lowballing it.
Okay, but how's this going to change BP, this whole event? Because they're selling stuff, they're getting smaller, right?
Well, at this point, it's true that the company has lost $70 billion in its worth since before the spill. And they're saying that they're going to be smaller and wiser. When you look at how they're actually going to be operating differently, they might go from 4 million barrels a day to 3.5 million barrels in production. That still puts them as the second largest oil company in the world. In terms of how they're going to pay for all of this, that's where they are changing things a little bit. They're planning on selling $30 billion in assets in the next year and a half. What's interesting, though, is that it doesn't look like they're selling a lot of these kind of risky deep sea offshore assets. I talked to Nick McGregor, who's an oil analyst in London at Redmond Bentley Brokerage, and he said that even after this spill and this nightmare that BP's gone through, they're probably going to keep focusing on high risk oil operations.
I think BP is in a difficult position because, having identified itself as a specialist in difficult-to-reach oil, exactly the sort of areas that they were working on in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, BP to turn on a sixpence and abandon that area would have a problem. What would be next?
What I'm hearing then, Chrissy, from you and from Mr. McGregor here is that it doesn't sound like BP is going to change its exploration strategy at all.
Right. And in some ways, they can't really, partly because a lot of that easy-to-reach onshore oil is increasingly controlled by sovereign nations in the Middle East, and partly because that's kind of the reputation that they've built themselves on. Speaking of reputations, one thing that they may be trying to change is their name, at least in terms of how we know them at gas stations in the U.S. There's some rumors that they might be going back back to Amoco as opposed to BP.
Chrissy Clark on the BP profit numbers this morning and what it means for the company. Chrissy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
For all those many months that Congress spent wrangling over financial reform, lawmakers intentionally left plenty of loose threads. Some of those threads are supposed to be worked out at some point by U.S. banking regulators. Others are going to be decided by a group of international officials. They're developing a set of global standards that are named for the town where those regulators are meeting. Basel, Switzerland is the place. And the question is, will those new international rules go beyond what Congress has delivered? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
After years of life in the fast lane, the world's bankers are about to have their financial vehicles loaded down with new safety equipment.
In good times, it's more fun to have the hot rod, but it doesn't leave you enough protection for when things go wrong.
Douglas Elliott is an expert on economic studies at the Brookings Institution. He says the Global Committee of Financial Regulators wants to cushion banks from unexpected shocks. They'd have to keep more cash in their vaults, $3 for every $100 they loan. Elliott says that's somewhat less than the rainy day nest egg the panel originally had in mind.
The more you require safety margins, the more expensive it is to make loans. And we want banks to make loans. So you've got this delicate balancing act. Add some safety to the system without making it too expensive.
Emphasis on the delicate. Elliott suggests the last rules out of the panel in 2004 may have inadvertently encouraged the riskier behavior that led to the global collapse.
In being too tough on some of the aspects, they forced banks to try to find clever ways to get around it, which did help compound the problems.
Elliott says that's why the panel is allowing up to 8 years for its new standards to be fully implemented. And banking industry consultant Bert Ely points out the clock on that hasn't even started yet.
They are reaching agreement on basic principles, but that's like getting the first 100 feet in a mile run. They have a long way to go in refining these rules, making them workable on a global basis, and then these rules have to be implemented by each of the individual countries.
Ely says he expects by that time bankers will be ready with a new round of workarounds. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It was the narrowest of split decisions on Wall Street today. Two indices down, one up, none by much either way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The economic stimulus bill that Congress and the White House passed last year had a whole bunch of stuff in it, obviously. $787 billion does cover a lot of ground. That includes more than $4 billion for the Department of Education's flagship reform program, Race to the Top. Today, Education Secretary Arne Duncan announced the next set of finalists in that race, 18 states plus the District of Columbia that made some major changes to how they go about the business of education. We are not here to talk about the winners, though. We have asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser to look at the states that overhauled their education systems and then lost the race. What are they supposed to do now?
There's a lot at stake in the Race to the Top competition. Hundreds of millions of dollars for states that agree to certain education reforms, like allowing more charter schools and tying teacher evaluations to student performance. When Education Secretary Arne Duncan announced the Race to the Top winners today, he said a tide of reform is sweeping through the nation's schools.
This entire process has moved the nation in advanced education reform. Children are the big winners here.
The Obama administration doesn't make out too badly either. It convinced many states to apply for Race to the Top money, got them to ram changes in education law through their legislatures and take on their teachers' unions. And some of those states still got nothing. The administration got the reforms it wanted just by dangling cash. University of Southern California education professor Gilbert Henschke.
They dangled it, and a lot of us responded. So it's pretty clever, don't you think?
Maybe. Secretary Duncan says states aren't going to roll back the reforms they promised just because they didn't get any money, but some cash-strapped states will have no choice. Jennifer Cohen analyzes education policy at the New America Foundation.
Following through on the reforms that they proposed in their Race to the Top applications may be impossible.
Secretary Duncan says never fear. He's got other education grants to dole out, at least this year. Next year may be different. Congress is in a budget-cutting mood. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
While BP ponders its dwindling fortunes, the cleanup in the Gulf continues. There are still plenty of questions about the U.S. response to the leak down along the Gulf Coast, in Washington, and in Europe, especially in the Netherlands. Nobody manages water as well as the Dutch do. Hardly surprising when more than 40% of the country is below sea level. They've been building dikes and pumping out floodplains for centuries now. And in Rotterdam, an enormous oil shipping port, the Dutch have developed one of the most sophisticated oil spill recovery programs on the planet. Expertise that the U.S. has yet to tap into. From Rotterdam, Stephen Beard reports.
Some companies do very well in the wake of a disaster, like the Campers marine construction firm. It makes the so-called sweeping arm oil skimmer.
Thanks to the world's largest oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, we are now at top production levels.
Cabot Campers says he's building three pairs of sweeping arms a week to send to the Gulf. That's how many he usually makes in a year. They cost $500,000 each, so Herbert is glad to get the extra business. But he says the U.S. would have been better off if his skimmers had been deployed at the outset.
If they had sweeping arm systems around from day one, these sweeping arms would have been able to sweep up close to 100% of all the oil that came out. It's a matter of scale.
Within days of the Deepwater Horizon blowing up, the Dutch government offered to send some of its sweeping arms to the Gulf. Initially, the offer was rebuffed. One reason? Because of the way the skimmer works. The arm sucks up huge quantities of oily water fast, separates it, stores the oil on the ship, and then drains the remaining water into the sea. But that breaks US pollution rules. Beard Koops represents the Dutch oil spill recovery industry.
We say we should recover as much oil as possible in as short time as possible. The Americans say we should recover pure oil and not to drain water which has been polluted by a small quantity of oil. And we say that is incredible, that is crazy, that is so stupid.
Because, he says, the US allowed tons of chemical dispersant to be pumped into the Gulf instead. Koops claims the whole fiasco demonstrates a fundamental flaw in the American approach.
In the U.S., the company who is polluting is responsible for the oil spill response, and I think that this is as well crazy.
He says BP opted at first to disperse and burn the slick, the cheapest and least effective method. In Europe, that would not happen because governments immediately take charge when there's a spill.
This is absolutely crucial because government has equipment, the government can take action immediately and not worrying about they will get the money back. They send it in immediately because they know that the polluter always will pay at the end.
BP has already set up a $20 billion fund to pay for the Gulf of Mexico spill. Some Dutch companies say the US is determined to ensure that only American firms profit from that fund.
Van Oord, specialists in marine and civil projects.
Van Oord, based in Rotterdam, is one of the world's biggest dredging companies. It offered to build a massive sand dune or berm to protect Louisiana's marshlands from the oil. The company was rebuffed. American contractors are now working on the berm. Bert Groothausen of Van Oord is not impressed with their work.
The top width is 20 foot only.
And that's too little in your view?
We had 300 foot. That's the sort of difference.
You think their dune, their berm, is not going to stand up to the tide?
Definitely not. One little storm and the berm is gone.
Groothausen believes that his company's plan was rejected out of pure protectionism and that other offers of Dutch help were rejected out of misplaced American pride.
What are you doing? Do you have a problem? Don't you have a problem? Now, we believe you have a problem with millions of liters of oil floating around. So clean the bloody mess. Yeah, get help. Get all the help you can get.
Although miffed, the Dutch say they're not entirely surprised by the US rejection. It's happened before. Following the Exxon Valdez oil tanker accident in 1989, a Dutch team flew into Alaska to offer their help. They were told they weren't needed and should go home. In Rotterdam, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
coming up.
So I could see that you're interested in doing a trip to Berkeley, San Francisco.
Well, yeah, but how do you know? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained a 0.1% today, 12 points, closed at 10,537. But the NASDAQ lost about a 0.3%, 8 points, 2288, the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 lost a 0.1%, 1 point, 1113 at the bell. Banks had a pretty good day. Wells Fargo picked up nearly 1.75%. J.P. Morgan Chase advanced 0.9%. Bank of America deposited more than 0.25%. Citigroup added just under 0.25%. On the earnings front, BP, as we told you, lost more than $17 billion last quarter. In U.S. trading, though, it lost more than 1.5%. DuPont did much better. Its quarterly profits nearly tripled over last year. Shares in the chemical giant jumped more than 3.5%. Today, Cummins, the big power equipment maker, also reported strong earnings. Its shares generated a 2% gain on the news. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.05%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders for June. The Federal Reserve publishes its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions. And the topic is superweeds. A House committee discusses the environmental impact of the evolution of herbicide-resistant weeds. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The economic conversation that's happening in Washington right now and that is likely to flavor this fall's elections pretty much revolves around one word, debt. How much money this country owes, which is a lot, and whether now is the time to go deeper in the hole to help get the economy going again. Economic historian Neil Ferguson has been fairly blunt in his view that the amount of debt we are carrying simply is not sustainable.
There is a fundamental imbalance between what we expect the federal government to spend on Medicare and Social Security and national security and what we're prepared to pay in taxation. And that is really the core of the issue. The Greeks found that out this year. My fear is that Americans may find this out next year or the year after.
That quickly.
Oh, absolutely. These things happen really dramatically because when the bond market turns its blinkered gaze in your direction and investors say, you know what, lending these people money for 10 years in return for 3.2% a year, isn't that smart? Maybe we should ask for a little bit more for the risk that we're taking. That's the kind of thing that happens very suddenly in international financial history.
Well, let me ask you then to concentrate on the historian part of your economic historian professional identity and go back and explain how it came to be that our economy runs this way.
Well, for most of the history of the United States, the federal government was a relatively small entity, and there was a time when it had no debt whatever. It's been since around 1979-80 that we've seen a sustained upward shift in the federal debt. And that's come about, I think, because of politics more than economics. Increasingly, Democrats became committed to public spending, and Republicans became committed to cutting taxes. And this unholy alliance, if you like, between tax cutters and public spenders created a fundamental imbalance between what was being spent by the federal government and what was being raised in taxation. And now we find ourselves in a situation where a structural deficit has been combined with a cyclical deficit due to the financial crisis. And we're now looking at a very acute fiscal crisis, the worst in American history.
What does a sovereign debt crisis, what might a sovereign debt crisis look like here? We know what it looks like with the Greeks. They eventually got bailed out. They had riots in the streets. What happens here?
Well, we have a little foretaste because there's already a fiscal crisis in America, and it's happening in the States. And what happens is that you find yourself actually having to cut public services and also raise taxes because you've reached the limit of your ability to borrow. If we find that, you know, 20 or 25 cents of every tax dollar that we pay is just going on interest payments, then you get into some very difficult choices. Do you put up taxes? Never very popular. Do you cut entitlements? These are the questions that are currently being asked at the state level. They will soon be having to be asked at the national level too.
What do we do, though? Is this the time to cut in the middle of a recession when still so many millions are out of work and the economy is struggling?
I think there's a false dichotomy here where essentially the problem is phrased as follows. Either we need more stimulus or we need austerity. I wouldn't envisage fiscal tightening in 2010 or 2011, but we need to have a credible plan so that by 2020 we're not running trillion-dollar deficits. And I'd like to hear it couched in the following form. We're going to reform the entitlements that are currently threatening to bankrupt the United States. We are going to introduce a federal sales tax or value-added tax, which will take some of the strain off income taxpayers. It's a big bang reform that we need. So this is the third option, not a further stimulus, not a ghastly austerity package which could push us back into recession, but radical fiscal reform that creates a foundation for more rapid growth and therefore for more job creation.
Neil Ferguson of Harvard University. His most recent book is called High Financier, The Lives and Times of Sigmund Warburg. Neil, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Kai.
Somewhere in the back of our minds, we all probably know that companies are keeping track of us. They want to know who we are. They want to know what we're interested in. They want to know what we buy. And they want to know how all that affects what we are likely to buy in the future. It's called data mining. Best estimates are it's a $100 billion a year business in this country. Yesterday, Marketplace's Stacey Manick-Smith told us how marketers are using our data to get better at selling things to us. Today, she offers some personal examples.
Data compilers have been gathering information on me, where I live and what I buy, since I left for college. Peter Harvey is the CEO of data mining company Intellidyne. He gives me the big picture.
So now we've got Stacy at apartment C on this street in L.A. It has your date of birth as December 1st, 1976.
December 26th, but okay.
You're a frequent internet user, cellular customer, and long-distance user. And it says you are an active credit card user.
Using that and my credit information, data miners slot me into one of 70 lifestyle categories, or clusters.
It put you in cluster number 26.
Which is?
Savvy singles. Savvy single households are well-educated and enjoy upper-middle income and live in multifamily dwelling units.
We're also workaholics, environmental activists, travelers, and mountain climbers. And we spend a lot of our money on fixing up our homes. Companies have been using my savvy singlehood as a way to sell me things for years. That might explain why I get so many Pottery Barn catalogs and promotions for Las Vegas getaways. I'm not actually that into Vegas. And that can be the problem with those broad categories. But things are getting a lot more personal. Because every time I look something up on my phone, send an email, or use my credit card, I'm leaving a trail of digital breadcrumbs.
Well, I know a fair amount about you now.
That's Robert Grossman, head of the National Center for Data Mining at the University of Chicago. He mined my information from Google and Facebook.
I know your hometown, which is Boise, Idaho. I know where you work. You worked pretty hard. But in the evening, you would watch TV shows like Glee, look at travel locations. You spend a lot of time looking at women's shoes and cosmetics.
I guess I like shoes and cosmetics. Grossman says marketers could use that information to send me ads for sandals and lip gloss after I got home from work and before I settle into...
I could see that you're interested in doing a trip to Berkeley, San Francisco.
Actually, I was in Berkeley, and Grossman noticed some differences in my behavior when I was there.
Los Angeles, you're interested in everything from museums to where to eat breakfast to where to get drinks. And Berkeley, you're interested in cakes, bars, and wine restaurants.
So in L.A., I'm interested in where to eat and where to get cocktails. And in Berkeley, I'm interested in where to eat and where to get wine. Can I just say I don't drink that much? But when I was in Berkeley for work, I did look up wine bars. And Grossman says the next time I'm there, I might get a text message from a wine bar near my hotel. So that's a little scary. And that's just Google. Then we got to Facebook, where marketers can find out information about the music and books I like, my real birthday, my relationship status, see pictures of what I did last weekend, get a heads up on what I'm planning to do this weekend, and see who my friends are, which Grossman says is marketing gold.
The likes of friends is one of the most predictive variables of your own likes.
So they know where I live, what I buy, my nutritional habits, what I watch, and who my friends are. What are they going to do with all of it? Grossman says they're going to try to sell me stuff. Stuff I'll probably want.
I think this is just going to make targeting more relevant. From that viewpoint, I think this is very, very good. So I would offer you women's shoes, cosmetics, travel, and TV shows.
Can I just say that I am not that into shoes? Anyway, Grossman points out that every day I trade my data for things I want. I let Amazon store my credit card information because it's convenient. I take online surveys to get discounts. And for no reason at all, I tell my 300 Facebook friends that I saw Twilight and liked it. But I am not just the sum of my data parts.
This is a very small portion of your life. It's just the part that can be monetized.
Because there is a lot more to me than shoe shopping and bar hopping. I did my senior thesis on Beckett. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For Marketplace.
She really did that Beckett thing, you know. Anyway, Stacey might be a savvy single, but there is more to life than that. Marketers lump us as platinum oldies and shooting stars, to name just a few. Stacey is online talking about those lifestyle clusters and the company that thought them up. It's on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today about the housing market. We had a conversation around the conference table here the other day about how there might be a double dip in housing prices. And I said to the guy who mentioned it, wait, how can we have a double dip in housing prices when they haven't even really gone up at all yet? I think I won the debate that day, but Robert Shiller, he of the widely quoted S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index, weighed in this morning. Shiller's numbers show housing prices did rise last month, thanks mostly to that now-expired tax credit. But he says he figures the risk of a housing-driven double-dip recession is probably about 50-50 right now. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained a tenth of 1%, 12 points. The NASDAQ lost a third percent, about 8 points. The S&P 500 lost a tenth. That is 1 point. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that is where you tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this program, what you give up when you give up oil.
Aspirin, glasses, contact lenses, computers. I could go on and on with that list. They would give your listeners a headache, but then they could take the aspirin and help cure it.
Oh, all right. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.